Chapter 1. The Sumerians, circa 4000 BCE to 2004 BCE. In 1625, an Italian nobleman named Pietro della Valle went on a tour of the Middle East. Della Valle was an eager traveller and spent much of his life in Persia, North Africa, and India. He married an Assyrian Christian princess in Damascus, and the two journeyed together across Mesopotamia, trekking on horses and camels across the deserts of what is now Iraq, accompanied by local guides. At the time, travel in this region was perilous. The Ottoman and Persian empires were at war, fighting over who would rule in Baghdad. And meanwhile, local bandits took advantage of the chaos to prey on travellers. As if that wasn't enough, lions roamed in the hills. Alert to these dangers, the guides were constantly on edge. And on the 18th of June, they spotted a distant group of Bedouins watching them from a dune. Unsure of their intentions, Della Valle's group beat a hasty retreat. They fled across the desert, searching for somewhere defensible to hide. That's when they spied a looming mass on the horizon, a strange form rising out of the desert. As they drew near, they saw that they were approaching a series of enormous and very ancient ruins. "For more security, we removed a mile further," Della Valle later wrote, "and took up our station under a little hill near some ruins of buildings, which we saw from far away." Della Valle's group camped in those ruins for several nights while the guides negotiated with the local chieftain for safe passage. During the day, under the intense heat of the Iraqi sun, Della Valle passed the time by walking among those crumbling monuments, as he later wrote in his memoirs. "Our removal hence, being still deferred, I went in the foremoon to take a more diligent view of the ruins of the above said ancient building. What it had been I could not understand, but I found it to have been built with very good bricks, most of which were stamped in the midst with certain unknown letters, which appeared very ancient. I observed that they had been cemented together in the fabric, not with lime, but with bitumen or pitch." Della Valle was fascinated by the broken fragments of clay brick and impressed by the unfamiliar symbols that littered the ground of this ruined place. He explored further and copied down some of the marks that he saw. "I found on the ground some pieces of black marble, hard and fine, engraven with the same letters as the bricks, which seemed to me to be a kind of seal. Amongst other letters which I discovered in that short time, two I found in many places, one of which was like a jacent pyramid, and the other resembled a star of 8 points. Although they couldn't have suspected it then, Della Valle and his wife had stumbled across the ruins of a city that had once been called Ur. It had been at the heart of one of mankind's first true civilizations, the Society of Sumer. It was here, in this now inhospitable waste, that much of the world we know today had its beginning." Eventually, negotiations with the local leader fell apart, and Della Valle's group left in the dead of night. In his bags, he carried away with him a few of the clay tablets that he had found at the site, which he took home as curiosities. They would be the first examples ever seen in Europe of a language that had not been spoken for millennia. Della Valle must have turned these fragments over in his hands, peered at their strange symbols, and wondered, who had built such enormous mounds of brick out there in the middle of the desert? What did the marks on those broken pieces of clay mean? And if a great city had once stood there, what in all the world could have happened to it? Mesopotamia is a name that in classical Greek means between the rivers. And since ancient times, it has been given to the lands that lie between the rushing Tigris and the winding Euphrates rivers, and which today we call Iraq. Since the earliest recorded history, Mesopotamia was also home to two distinct major cultures, the peoples of Sumer and Akkad. We know a reasonable amount about the Akkadian people in the north. They spoke a language in the Semitic group, the family of Aramaic, Hebrew, and Arabic, and which was indigenous to the region, sharing grammar and words with other languages originating nearby. But the Sumerian people of southern Iraq are more mysterious. In fact, the question of where they came from remains such a mystery that archaeologists have referred to it as the Sumerian problem. Sumerians spoke what we call a language isolate. That is, it has no relation to any of the languages around it, and was effectively in a linguistic family all of its own. Sumerian was so alien to the region that early scholars who discovered its first texts didn't believe it could be a real language at all, and assumed it was a kind of code. This alone has led some to question whether the Sumerians arrived in southern Iraq from somewhere else. The Sumerian culture centered on the coast of Iraq's far south, and so it has been suggested that they may have arrived by boat, possibly from Oman or Qatar. Early Sumerian legends refer to an ancestral homeland known as Dilmun, an Edenic paradise where the raven uttered no cries, the lion killed not, and the wolf snatched not the lamb. Unknown was the kid-killing dog. Unknown was the grain-devouring boar. Further support for this theory may come from the writings of the Roman historian Flavius Josephus, who recounts a legend from the now-vanished writings of a Hellenic-era Babylonian priest named Barossos. It tells the story of a figure called Oannes, half man, half fish, who walked out of the sea and taught the people of Mesopotamia the secrets of culture. He had the whole body of a fish, but above his fish's head, he had another head, which was that of a man. And human feet emerged from beneath his fish's tail. He had a human voice. He taught them the use of letters, sciences, and arts of all kinds, the rules for the founding of cities and the construction of temples, the principles of law and of surveying. He showed them how to sow and reap. Having revealed these secrets, Oannes leapt back into the sea and swam away. It's possible that in this myth, ancient storytellers have preserved a memory of the arrival of the Sumerians, landing en masse by boat and bringing with them their strange language and advanced urban culture. Some have even argued that the Sumerians may have come from as far afield as the Indus Valley in modern Pakistan. And genetic analysis has shown that certainly some population exchange took place between the Persian Gulf and the Indus Valley during the civilization's long history. Meanwhile, others have proposed a more outlandish theory, which once again finds its roots in mythology. The Sumerians believed that in the time of their distant ancestors, a great flood had washed over the world. This same story would later pass into the legends of the Babylonian Empire, and from there to the Hebrew poet historians who wrote the first books of the Bible. The story of the Great Flood is perhaps the oldest continuously told story, and it's in this legend that we might find a clue to Sumerian origins. The story of the flood is so striking that many historians, and no shortage of pseudo-historians, have tried to come up with a historical event that may have inspired it. But it may genuinely find its roots in real human experience. When the last ice age, or glacial maximum, began to end around 18,000 years ago, global temperatures started to rise and would ultimately increase between 4 and 7 degrees. Up to that point, immense ice sheets had reached from the North Pole as far south as modern-day Berlin. But as temperatures rose, these ice caps melted, and their water poured back into the oceans. Combined with the expansion of oceanic water on a warming planet, this caused global sea levels to creep up by an average of 2.5 centimeters a year, until they had risen 120 meters, or enough to submerge a 40-story building. The sea engulfed vast regions of the coast. The land bridge that had once connected Russia and Alaska was inundated, separating Asia and the Americas, as were the low-lying regions of what is now the North Sea, turning Great Britain into an island. In Mesopotamia, the effects were just as dramatic. During the Ice Age, the Tigris and Euphrates had flowed on for a further 900 kilometers down a flat, fertile valley of marshlands and forests, emerging into the Indian Ocean beyond where the Strait of Hormuz is today. It would have been the perfect place for human settlements, and it's likely that people made their homes here. But this landscape's days were numbered. As the glaciers melted, the Strait of Hormuz opened around 14,000 years ago. After that, the coastline moved inland across the flat riverine landscape at an average rate of more than 60 meters a year, or more than a meter every week. Although the flooding likely happened in fits and starts as it moved over the landforms. For any humans living in this region at the time, this event must have been utterly terrifying. These people could have watched the sea advance by kilometers in their lifetime. And the next centuries would see them driven north by the encroaching waves, which swallowed whole forests and villages. They would have been unable to settle anywhere for very long, and been forced to adapt as they went. This gradual flight would have continued until the planet's temperature stabilized and the coast reached its highest point around 5000 BCE. This happens to be right around the time that Sumerian culture as we know it burst onto the historical stage. At the same time, Semitic farmers speaking an ancestor language of Akkadian were moving down the rivers from the northern mountains. They would have met this beleaguered and unfamiliar population fleeing from the south, carrying everything they owned with them, and telling tales of a flood that had drowned the whole world. However the Sumerians arrived, their relationship with the more northerly Akkadian peoples formed one of the earliest and most successful examples of cultural symbiosis in the ancient world. The Sumerians referred to themselves as Ugsaggegar, or the black-headed people, and the Akkadians called them Tzalmat-Kakadi, which meant the same thing in their own language. This suggests that something about their appearance may have set them apart from other peoples in the region. Some early anthropologists even resorted to studying the skulls they found in Mesopotamia and comparing them to depictions in Sumerian carvings. A discredited practice. But even in the age of DNA analysis, we don't have a clear idea of who the Sumerians were. Human remains in this region are usually badly preserved, and even if it were possible to get good readings on DNA, it would be difficult to link any one genetic group to the ancient Sumerians with any certainty. Bilingualism was clearly widespread for much of their history, and vocabulary and cultural practices flowed back and forth between groups, further blurring distinctions. But one thing we know. Over the following centuries, the Semitic Akkadians and the Sumerians lived side by side in such a way that their cultures ran in parallel, just like their two great rivers. They shared their successes and advances, and they shared the cities that by 4000 BCE were quickly growing to become the largest ever seen. But they would also share their failures, and for the next 2000 years, their fates were inextricably intertwined. From carvings and other artifacts that depict Sumerians, we can see how they wore their hair, curly on top and cut short on the sides. Common men wore sheepskin kilts, while the rich wore coloured fabrics spun from wool, decorated with tassels and beads. Among the wealthy, both men and women wore jewellery, anklets, bracelets, necklaces and ear ornaments, made of copper and sometimes gold. The Sumerians believed that the world was a roughly circular landmass, surrounded on all sides by a huge body of water. They believed that another ocean also lay above their heads, held in place by the solid structure of the sky, which occasionally let some of this water through as rain. Sumerians called their homeland Ki-Engir, which means the land of the noble lords. To describe the settled societies of the Sumerians and Akkadians, they used the word Kalam, meaning civilized, while Kur, which was used to describe the mountainous zones bordering the plains, came to have an additional meaning, rebellious, barbarous, and wild. And that's how the outside world must have looked to them. To their south and west, the deserts of Arabia yawned, a rolling sea of sand dunes where no crops could grow, home to nomadic warrior clans. To the north, the rocky Taurus Mountains hemmed them in, full of hardy mountain people, while the Zagros Mountains of Iran formed the edge of their world to the east. The Sumerians made use of the pottery wheel, the wagon wheel, the plough, and the sailboat. Their buildings used complex arches and domes, and in fact their builders mastered all the architectural techniques that would go on to be used before the age of steel and concrete. They worked out how to cast metals such as copper and later bronze. They were avid mathematicians and accountants, and developed complex systems of measurement, as well as methods for dividing and multiplying, even writing down the first ever multiplication tables on clay tablets. In fact, we still use Sumerian mathematics every day. Their number system worked on a base of 60 rather than our own decimal system. And they divided time into the units we use to this day. 60 seconds in a minute, 60 minutes in an hour, as well as the 360 degrees in angle measurement. It's thought that they would count to 12, using the three bones in each of their four fingers, tapping each one with their thumb, while keeping count of the 12s on their other hand's fingers. Once five fingers were held up, they had reached 60. Thanks to this spark of ingenuity, Sumerian society grew at a steady pace, despite the challenges of their landscape. They had little stone or wood, so instead they learned to build with the river mud, mixing it with straw, gravel, and broken pottery, and baking the resulting bricks in the sun or in kilns. With clay, they made everything from pots and plates to sickles and writing tablets. Just as they are in the Iraqi marshes today, buildings were also constructed out of reeds, bound together in huge quantities into strong beams up to a meter thick. They dug networks of irrigation canals that extended the agricultural zone around the rivers and facilitated the transportation of goods by boat. They built dams to regulate the flow of the rivers and control the spring floods, and used a grand array of words for all the different water control mechanisms they used. Gradually, the landscape of southern Iraq transformed from dusty salt flats and marshy swamps to a green patchwork of farmland, where wheat, millet, and sesame could be grown. The Sumerians planted orchards of nutritious dates, and in the shade beneath these tough palms, they planted more delicate pomegranates, grapes, figs, chickpeas, lentils, leeks, garlic, cucumbers, and watercress. Archaeological evidence shows that the Mesopotamians of antiquity enjoyed a richer diet than their neighbors. And we have uncovered Sumerian recipes on clay tablets. The recipe for a dish they called tuhu gives a sense of the variety they enjoyed. Tuhu. Leg meat is used. You prepare the water. You add fat. You sear. You fold in salt, beer, onion, arugula, cilantro, Persian shallot, cumin, and red beet. And you crush leek and garlic. You sprinkle coriander on top. Many historians have argued that it was the digging of these canals and watercourses that led to the developing social organization of the Sumerian period. Extensive systems of water management required careful planning, engineering expertise, and mathematical calculations, not something that could be achieved without significant planning. Work teams needed to be organized and paid in food and beer, foremen and overseers appointed, complex water systems mapped out. All of this led to a kind of early bureaucracy that in turn gave rise to the first true states. It's no coincidence that for these early Sumerians, the god of water, Enki, sat at the top of their pantheon. One Sumerian myth credits him with bringing order to the southern marshes. The plow and the yoke he directed. The great prince Enki opened the holy furrows, made grain grow in the perennial field. The Lord, the jewel and ornament of the plain, fitted out on its strength. Enlil's farmer, Enkimdu, the god of the canals and ditches, Enki placed in their charge. According to Sumerian texts, the first city in the region was Eridu. One document known as the Sumerian King List describes it as the place where Enki first decided that a king should rule. When kingship from heaven was lowered, the kingship was in Eridu. In Eridu, Alulim became king. He ruled for 28,800 years. Alalngar ruled for 36,000 years. Archaeology shows the city of Eridu was founded around 5,400 BCE and was populated by Sumerian speakers. Soon, it was just one of a constellation of small Sumerian cities that dotted southern Iraq. At the time, populations of woolly mammoths, survivors of the end of the Ice Age, still roamed in remote parts of the Arctic. The cities of Sumer were not the first large human settlements. Excavations at the site of Çatalhöyük, 7,500 BCE, and the even older Göbekli Tepe, 9,500 BCE, have shown that humans had already lived in so-called proto-cities for millennia. These were often anarchic, self-organized communities that looked something like a Brazilian favela, and their constructions showed no evidence of central government or urban planning. In Sumer, we see the rise of the first true city-states. These were relatively small, the most populous probably having no more than about 10,000 inhabitants, and were centered around their temples and ruled by priest kings known as Ensi. Records show that an Ensi was often assisted by a semi-democratic council of elders, which included both men and women. Their borders were defined by the courses of canals and by specially carved boundary stones. During this time, art and architecture began to take on the style that we would consider distinctively Sumerian, and technology also took leaps forward. What's more, this early era seems to have been one of relative peace. There's little evidence for organized warfare or the keeping of professional soldiers in these early cities, and most towns went without walls. But this would not last for long. One ancient Sumerian myth, called the Gifts of Inanna, seems to capture some of the spirit of this period of transition. It describes technology and the refinements of settled society being handed down by Enki to his daughter, the goddess Inanna, who later passes them down to the people of Sumer. Holy Inanna received the craft of the carpenter, the craft of the coppersmith, the craft of the scribe, the craft of the smith, the craft of the leather worker, the craft of the builder, the craft of the reed worker. Holy Inanna received wisdom, attentiveness, holy purification rites, the shepherd's hut, piling up glowing charcoals, the sheepfold, respect, awe, reverent silence. Enki teaches Inanna about family, the proper laws of inheritance and the art of good judgment. But he also goes on to give her other gifts, which show that the darker side of civilization was already making itself known. Holy Inanna received deceit and the rebel lands. Holy Inanna received heroism, power, wickedness, the plundering of cities, and the making of lamentations. From their peaceful beginnings, the Sumerians were already learning what Walter Benjamin would one day write. There is no document of civilization that is not at the same time a document of barbarism. Nevertheless, their cities grew, drawing in more people, creating their own gravity, putting pressure on various systems. Out of that pressure, sometime around 3200 BCE, came an extraordinary invention, like the birth of a star that would flood the era with light, the written word. One Sumerian epic poem called Enmerkar and the Lord of Arata gives the first known story about the invention of writing, by a king who has to send so many messages that his messenger can't remember them all. His speech was substantial and its contents extensive, because the messenger whose mouth was tired was not able to repeat it. The Lord of Kulaba patted some clay and wrote the message as if on a tablet. Formerly, the writing of messages on clay was not established. Now, under the sun on that day, it was indeed so. The Sumerians had two things in virtually limitless abundance: the clay beneath their feet and the reeds that grew on the marshes and riverbanks. And these combined to create the written word. They made marks on palm-sized tablets of wet clay with the ends of cut reeds. And the distinctive shape of these impressions gives this form of writing its name, from the Latin for wedge-shaped, cuneiform. The oldest cuneiform clay tablets come from the Sumerian city of Uruk and date to the late 4th millennium BCE. They are ergonomically shaped to the human hand, and as a result are roughly the dimensions of a modern smartphone. Cuneiform was at first made up of some 1,500 pictograms that each represented a whole word. But scribes had to work fast, copying hundreds of documents throughout their day. Over time, the original pictographs naturally became simpler and more abstract. Around this time, someone had the bright idea that each symbol could also stand for a certain sound, instead of a whole idea. And after 3000 BCE, this meant the number of symbols was reduced from some 1500 to about 600. These were the beginnings of the first alphabets. The human brain would never be the same again, and in large part thanks to this new ability to record and pass on knowledge, the technology of Sumer made even greater leaps forward. This phase of Mesopotamian history is known as the Uruk period, which lasted until the end of the 4th millennium BCE. One of the key markers of the shift into this period is a dramatic change in the region's pottery, but it did not become more sophisticated and ornate as technology improved. In fact, the pottery of the preceding Ubaid period was exceptionally beautiful, made on a device known as a slow wheel and painted with distinctive geometrical designs in brown or black glaze. These were luxury items for the wealthy few. The Uruk period, by contrast, saw a significant increase in the amount of pottery produced, but the quality fell dramatically. Thanks to the new fast wheel, clay jars and pots could be made in great numbers by workmen in intensive workshops, and they could now be afforded by everyone. This was the first era of mass production. In their clay documents, the buzzing economy of the Sumerian cities comes to life in a slew of numbers. We know that in Girsu, for instance, 15,000 women were employed in the textile industry. One factory produced 1,100 tons of flour in a year, but also bread, beer, and linseed oil, as well as grindstones, woven reeds, and clay pots. This factory employed 134 specialists and 858 skilled workers, of which 669 were women, 86 were men, and 103 were teenagers of both genders. Since there was no currency at this time, workers were paid directly in food and other goods. The minimum ration of an unskilled factory worker consisted of 20 liters of barley a month, along with 2 liters of oil and 2 kilos of wool per year. While their supervisor might earn twice this ration, poorer workers sometimes had to supplement their income by borrowing commodities, like silver, grain, or wool, from lenders, always at crushing interest rates. Of all the Sumerian settlements, the one that would rise to the greatest heights was the one that gave the period its name, Uruk. By the end of the 4th millennium BCE, when the earliest of the Egyptian pyramids was still at least 400 years in the future, and the large stones at Stonehenge would not be laid for another 800 years, the city of Uruk and its surrounding metropolitan area had swelled to some 90,000 inhabitants and covered 2.5 square kilometers. It was the largest settlement the world had yet seen. Humanity's earliest surviving work of literature, the Epic of Gilgamesh, begins in Uruk. The real King Gilgamesh probably ruled over the city in the early 3rd millennium BCE and made enough of an impression that he went down in legend as a mythical hero, 2/3 god and 1/3 man. Over the centuries that followed, his stories were likely passed by word of mouth before being set down on clay by later Babylonian and Assyrian scribes. Although it contains far more myth than historical fact, the Epic of Gilgamesh does tell us about how Sumerian society was changing. For one thing, it's evident that warfare was beginning to increase. As the tale opens, one feature of the city is repeatedly mentioned as a source of pride: a ring of enormous fortified walls. Ascend and walk about on the wall of Uruk. Inspect the cornerstone and examine its brickwork. Are its walls not made of burned brick, and its foundation overlaid with pitch? We can surmise that city walls were by now necessary for a powerful metropolis like strong-walled Uruk. 3 years the enemy besieged the city of Uruk. The city's gates were barred, the bolts were shot, and even Ishtar the goddess could not make head against the enemy. At the center of the city rose a temple to the goddess Ishtar, and also the famous White Temple, a four-story sanctuary dedicated to the sky god Anu, which could be seen from some distance across the plain of Sumer. It was covered in white gypsum plaster that would have reflected the sunlight during the day and moonlight after dark. The Epic of Gilgamesh gives us a sense of the bustling religious life of these temples. Three shah of oil the men carrying it in vessels. One shah of oil I kept out and used it for sacrifices, while the other two shah the boatmen stowed away. For the temple of the gods I slaughtered oxen, I killed lambs day by day. Jugs of cider, of oil, and of sweet wine, like river water, I poured out as libations. If you walked the streets of Uruk during this time, you would see markets full of produce, beans and lentils, pomegranates and dates, jars of date syrup and oil, and smelled the smoke from kilns and bread ovens, and all the pungent aromas of an ancient city. In the richer parts of town, houses were built from baked bricks, but elsewhere the clay-built houses were crowded into a chaotic labyrinth of alleys and warrens, likely covered by reed matting to keep out the midday heat, as people still do in parts of Iraq today. You would see farmers carrying large sheaves of reeds and wheat on their backs, and drovers bringing their long-haired sheep and oxen in from the fields, while women worked as weavers, ground flour, towed boats along canals, gathered clay and sand, and wove baskets out of rushes. You would have seen circles of men in shaded courtyards, sharing a large jar of beer flavored with herbs and honey, all sipping through long straws made of hollow reeds. With trade routes reaching as far as India, the influence of the metropolitan Uruk civilization spread like ripples on a pond, and its success soon spawned local copycats. As the third millennium drew to a close, another Sumerian city was rising that would soon take Uruk's place as the preeminent regional power. The name of that city was Ur. Ur was a coastal city, situated right at the point where the Euphrates River met the sea, and this made it a booming trade hub. As we've already seen, if you needed clay or reeds, southern Iraq was the place to be. But virtually every other resource the Sumerians required, they had to import. Fortunately, they always had something to trade. They were alone among almost the whole of the ancient Near East in producing a large surplus and variety of food. And so they quickly became the breadbasket of the region. In return for these staples, valuable goods flowed back. Copper came down from the mountains of northwestern Iran, Armenia, and later by ship from the island of Cyprus, while tin to make bronze travelled through the long mountain passes from Afghanistan. Silver came down the Euphrates on barges from Turkey's Taurus Mountains, while gold came overland from Egypt and by ship from India. Ordinary timber for building work could be chopped in the Zagros Mountains of Iran to the east, but for finer constructions, for palaces and ornate city gates, only the prized timber of the cedar tree would do. This was brought overland and then down the Euphrates from the mountains of Lebanon. One episode in the Epic of Gilgamesh relates the king's quest to slay a monster in these hills, steal this beautiful wood from the forest it guards, tie the lumber into a raft, and float it back downriver to Suma. From their tiny coast on the Persian Gulf, the Sumerians sent their ships out to ports in modern Bahrain and Oman, and from there along the coast to trade with another of the world's most ancient and mysterious cultures, the people we know today as the Indus Valley Civilization. This was the likely source of all kinds of spices and gemstones like carnelian and brilliant blue lapis lazuli, which the Sumerians adored and used to make jewelry and amulets, inlays in gaming boards, musical instruments and sculptures of delicate beauty. Grave goods uncovered in Ur show not only incredible wealth concentrated in the hands of its elite, but also magnificent craftsmanship, suggesting a sophisticated community of artists. One such artifact found in a royal tomb in Ur gives an unparalleled insight into the lives of the ancient Sumerians. It's a small ornate decorative piece of furniture inlaid with an intricate mosaic of shell, red limestone and lapis lazuli that depicts detailed scenes from everyday life 4,600 years ago. Today, it is called the Standard of Ur. On one side, it shows images of the Sumerians at war, the four-wheeled chariots pulled by donkeys, the soldiers wearing leather capes and helmets, the men carrying spears and axes. On the other side, it portrays the Sumerians at peace, a row of farmers and herders at work, shaved-headed scribes sitting at their desks, a musician playing a lyre for the king. By the mid-third millennium BCE, urbanism in the Sumerian world was reaching its peak, and the economic might of Ur reigned supreme. But within only a handful of centuries, the influence of Ur began to wane. A new militarized age dawned. City walls were thrown up around the region, and the power of trade and diplomacy seems no longer to have been sufficient. One city which came into its own in this new era of violence was Lagash. This was a slaving city on the river Tigris that had grown rich by raiding villages in the hills, kidnapping people and trafficking them across the region. Sometime around 2500 BCE, the ruler of Lagash, a man named Eanatum, fell out with the neighboring city of Umma, seemingly over a stretch of farmland along the river. The two cities went to war, and one carved stone monument captures something of the spirit of this age. It is known as the Stele of the Vultures. The upper part of the stele shows King Eanatum of Lagash leading his soldiers into battle, armed with spears and javelins. The inscription reads, "A man of the wind, Eanatum in Umma, like a destructive storm of rain, he left behind a deluge. Umma he defeated, and 20 ruined mounds for it he heaped up there." The carving is explicit and violent. As the soldiers of Umma try to flee the bloody battlefield, the army of Lagash cuts them down and tramples them beneath their feet. Overhead, vultures wheel, with the severed heads of the soldiers of Umma in their beaks. They feast on the tongues and eyes. There's a particular kind of nasty, pitiless relish in this portrait of the massacre that seems to embody a change in the spirit of Sumerian warfare. Perhaps aided by the merciless ethos depicted in the carving, the slaving city of Lagash went on to conquer much of southern Mesopotamia and establish what some historians have called the first true empire in the world. But this empire of Lagash would last for only about 100 years. In these times, administrating even one city could be a challenge, and Lagash was soon critically overstretched. King Eannatum passed his throne on to his brother, and then down a succession of kings, until a man named Urukagina sat on the throne. It was at this point that the subjugated city of Umma seized its chance, led by a ruler named Lugal Zaghezi. It's not clear exactly what made Lugal Zaghezi so successful, but he seems to have fostered an ardent desire for revenge against the empire of Lagash. He quickly toppled the kings of Kish and Larsa, who were still loyal to the empire, and then marched on Ur and Uruk. These fell in turn, and Lugal Zaghezi moved his capital to the mighty walled fortress of Uruk. Finally, he marched on Lagash itself. The king of Lagash, Urukagina, didn't hold out for long. Lugal Zaghezi burst through its walls, sacked the city, and burned it to the ground. Even by the standards of the time, this was a shocking act, and one recovered clay tablet, apparently written by a scribe or priest living in Lagash, recounts with rage and sorrow the sacking of the city. The men of Umma, by the despoiling of Lagash, have committed a sin against the god Ningirsu. The power that has come unto them, from them should be taken away. Of sin on the part of Urukagina, king of Girsu, there is none. But as for Lugal Zaghezi, Patesi of Umma, may his goddess Nidaba bear this sin upon her head. After sacking Lagash, Lugal Zaghezi's momentum was unstoppable. He worked his way north up the course of the two rivers. Soon he had conquered all the regions that Lagash had once claimed. One inscription written by him even claims to have conquered all the lands between what he calls the upper and lower seas, meaning all the way from the Persian Gulf to the Mediterranean coast. When the god Enlil, the king of the lands, had bestowed upon Lugal Zaghezi the kingdom of the land, he had conquered them from the rising of the sun unto the setting of the same. At that time he had made straight his path from the lower sea over the Euphrates and the Tigris up unto the upper sea. From the rising of the sun unto the setting of the same has Enlil granted him dominion. This is probably an exaggeration. And in fact, archaeology shows that the Sumerians were never able to maintain distant colonies for very long. More likely, Lugal Zaghezi pulled off a successful raiding party on the Mediterranean coast, burning and looting and bringing treasure back to Uruk. Still, this was the first time that a Sumerian prince had ever made such a bold claim, and it would leave a lasting impression. From then on, the idea of a king who could conquer all the lands between the seas would possess the imaginations of all the rulers who came after. Despite his successes, King Lugal Zaghezi, like the rulers of Lagash before him, soon found himself overstretched. His empire simply grew too big for the administrative capacity of the time. And before long, civil wars and rebellions broke out between the various Sumerian city-states. In this time of chaos, the other great people of Mesopotamia began to fancy their chances at ruling. The people who, up until this moment, had been something of a junior partner in the civilization of southern Iraq, the Akkadians. One man would soon lead them in an outright civil war against the ruling Sumerians. He would go down in history with a name that in Akkadian means the one true king. That name was Sargon, and he ushered in the twilight of the Sumerian Age.